The truth is that things are going to get tougher in Afghanistan before they get better.
When the White House announces its much-awaited strategy on Afghanistan next week, it will definitely have the fingerprints of that man, Vice President Joe Biden, whose role advising the president on foreign policy has been pivotal. This weekend's New York Times Magazine has a profile of Vice President Biden written by James Traub. James Traub, first of all, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.
One thing we know about Joe Biden's legacy, he will not go down in history as the most powerful vice president in the history of the United States. What's the chance he'll go down as maybe the second most powerful?
I think right now that's the direction he's heading in. I mean, he won't be the most powerful because, you know, if you want to sound conspiratorial, you could say there was a kind of soft coup that Cheney fomented. God knows you don't want to follow that model. I think as Biden proves himself more and more valuable in these foreign policy debates, and I can only think Afghanistan will cement his position, that his role in just at a thousand moments advising Obama, his indispensability will grow. And therefore, yes, he'll be the second most powerful vice president ever.
He benefits from being the predecessor to or having Dick Cheney as his predecessor.
Right. He benefits in the obvious way that you always want to succeed somebody who other people hated because you could just do okay and they like you. But in the less obvious way, it's true that Cheney so altered our sense of what a vice president can be. To take a small example, Cheney always got to interview Supreme Court candidates. Now, to my knowledge, no vice president had ever done that before. Mm. Biden did that, but there wasn't a word in the press about it. Why? Well, because it's the new normal.
It's so interesting. And of course, this completely defines his role in the National Security Council and the national security establishment. He has a bigger seat at the table than, say, an Al Gore would have had. And all of his expertise comes to really set the tone for how the Obama administration makes decisions. You said, in a sense, that he doesn't shut up. He doesn't stop talking. He's likely to go off the cuff. This is kind of an asset for him in the national security debate, you write.
I think it has been especially so in Afghanistan. I think this is where people's roles have started to clarify themselves. So his outspokenness, his willingness to say stuff other people don't say, yeah, you could find examples of that, but I don't know how much it mattered. Afghanistan, from the beginning, he's taken a position contrary to the one of the chiefs, contrary to McChrystal, contrary to Metraeus. Not easy to do, especially if you're a Democratic administration. Other people weren't agreeing with him, but he kept hammering away at this argument, we can't do this nationwide counterinsurgency thing. We may want to, but we can't. And his willingness and ability to say that has almost certainly moved the debate in that direction, though I think it will not come out where Biden himself would like to have it come out.
And that's not necessarily a defeat for him.
No, I think, look, it's a defeat in the limited sense that he has a policy preference. It's not going to come out there. But what he kept pointing me towards and other people as well is there really are two different issues, troops and the goal.
Mm-hmm.
And Biden's argument from the outset has been, let's narrow down the goal to what is absolutely essential and then figure out how many troops we need to achieve it. So my guess is that when we hear about this stuff next week, the goals are going to sound more narrowly circumscribed than they did in the McChrystal report. And that will be in part owing to Biden, though the troop numbers will be more like what McChrystal wanted.
Fascinating. You describe Joe Biden here, the vice president, as a gifted expostulator, okay, which means he loves to talk. All right, that's sort of obvious. But this one is fantastic to me. An indifferent schemer, which seems like the rarest conceivable bird in Washington, an indifferent schemer. What do you mean by that?
Well, I may be giving him too much credit. I was comparing the Obama administration to the Bush administration. And my point was that Bush, by his ignorance about foreign policy, created a vacuum, which others schemed to fill. And the master schemer of all was Rumsfeld, you know, whose behavior was incredibly, almost baroquely cynical. The Obama administration doesn't encourage that. First of all, everyone knows that power is concentrated in the White House. These calls are made by Obama, perhaps to an excessive degree. But so there's no lack, there's no ambiguity about how authority runs. There also are, so far as I can tell, very few of these mini dramas that beset the Bush administration as between, for example, Condi Rice as national security advisor and Cheney or her and Rumsfeld.
Right.
So the way in which policy plays out emphasizes your ability to make a case, to make a tough case in as complicated a form as you need to, doesn't really advantage being a ruthless inside player. So that plays to Biden's relative advantages.
Exactly. And so I guess the idea that the president has given Joe Biden a portfolio called Iraq, at least while the focus is on Afghanistan now, what does that mean for him? What is a victory for Joe Biden and the vice presidency in being responsible for what's going on in Iraq? And right now, you know, the idea is this is a withdrawal that we're in the middle
of. Yeah. You know, Iraq is in some sense a non-controversial issue inside the administration. It's the opposite of Afghanistan. There really isn't a whole lot of difference of opinion even between the administration and the Republicans. So the point is, how can we manage this drawdown in a not simply subtractive way? How can we use the remaining power we have to try to bring together these conflicting parties? And so it's a profoundly political moment. And Biden there, I think, has those political instincts. The guy was a senator for 36 years. And so he looks at these warring characters, Sunni, Shia, Kurd, and says, okay.
Al-Maliki, Muqtada al-Sadr, like he's talking about, representatives in Maryland
or
Delaware.
Know, that's how he talks. I mean, he talks about Maliki. He says, you know, now I see what his problem is. You know, he's broken apart his coalition. He's trying to be a national figure. But, you know, this, after all, it's a parliamentary form of government. So he's got to get his party elected, not him. So who else can he bring into his coalition? Yeah. So he's thinking like a politician. And the fact is, these guys themselves facing an election in January or February are at a profoundly political moment.
And he loves being in the middle of it.
He loves it.
Well, it's a fascinating window into the Obama administration and a fascinating profile of someone we think we know, Vice President Joseph Biden, formerly the senator from the state of Delaware. James Traub, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
James Traub is the author of The Freedom Agenda, Why America Must Spread Democracy, Just Not the Way George Bush Did.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.